evening. This is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California. It's tape number 389, inside one, and it's May the 18th, 1979. Remember the old fairy tale or the folk story about the sky is falling and Chicken Little warning about the sky is falling? I think of that as I read the newspapers. There's articles each week. There was another one this week about the Skylab that is falling. This one is for real. Maybe the little fairy stories were in preparation for the reality or whatever. NASA is going to plan medical and legal aid for the victims of the falling spacecraft. There's an article this week, May the 14th, that they're making arrangements to take care of you medically and legally if you're hit on the head by their Skylab. It won't be coming down until June 20th, approximately between June 20th and July 4th, somewhere between the anniversary of Watergate and the American Revolution. That's the week that they expect it to fall, and they can't predict where it's going to land. The North American Air Defense Command in Colorado Springs has explained that 85-ton space giant will come down to the Earth around this time, and that there's going to be about 400 to 500 pieces that will survive and scatter over the globe. And they expect an area, certain areas, large water masses and land masses can be vulnerable to two large chunks, each weighing 2 tons. And then there's other large, much larger pieces, one weighing 5,000 pounds, and that's an airlock shroud. And there's a lead-lined film vault weighing 4,000 pounds, and there's 6 oxygen tanks weighing 2,700 pounds each. And then there's some little pieces that'll be weighing around 10 pounds that'll be coming towards the Earth. You have a month to wait for that, but you might want to see your lawyer, write your will, or make some guesses and watch the Skylab fall. But right now they're planning medical and legal aid for the victims, whoever they are going to be. People are always asking me how I keep my good nature with all the bad news that's coming down, and I found the answer to that question in Mad Magazine, that I read as regularly as I do my other publications. There's a picture of a gentleman complaining about world conditions, and he's talking about the 11 o'clock news. He says it's terrible. Everything is terrible. The communist tentacles are grasping Africa, Asia, Europe, and the Americas. The Middle East is a hot spot. OPEC is greedy, and they're ruining the world's economics. There's racial tensions everywhere that could explode into civil war. And he shouts, "Isn't there any good news anywhere in this troubled world?" And then the woman behind him is standing on a scale, and she says, "Sure there is. I know some really great news. I lost a half a pound today." So I guess the days that I go on a diet and lose a half a pound, that balances it all out. And she's smiling and she's very happy. And that's how you face the world. You can eat a lot and pudge and then put away that ice cream and then lose a half a pound. And everything looks great no matter what's going on. And I thought that was pretty good. That was in Man Magazine this month. And that explains why I have such good days. I don't have to worry. I've got some I can lose. And so when the world falls down, I've lost a half a pound. It's a good day. There was another cartoon of Conrad's, the syndicated column, and it shows the cars lining up bumper to bumper. Many of you may have seen it, and the man in front is screaming and yelling, "I'm mad as hell, and if I can ever find out who's doing it to me, I'm not going to take it anymore." Remember the movie Network where they yelled out the window, "I'm not going to take it anymore." That's the importance of reading the books and sending for books, going to your library or buying them, reading the newspapers. You can find out if you want to make a study of it. And those who have studied it know who is doing the pushing and shoving. And it isn't hard to figure out. It's hard to figure out if you are entertaining yourself and not delving into these questions. But all of you who take this work seriously, who take these tapes, know that you have a pretty good idea of some of the people who are behind the machinery that is doing this. And it's those people who haven't studied it at all, who stand in these large lines for hours and hours and can't figure out anything about how these conspiracies are taking place. They could buy books or read them, again, at libraries just on the oil conspiracies, and they would understand the politics of oil, or on the Nobel family or the Rockefeller family and Gulf oil. And they could read a lot about Doheny oil and President Harding and the Hughes oil bit, the tool bit, and you can put together, after reading four or five books on oil, pretty much what's coming down. But in the cartoon, he shows them all lined up, and he says, if I can find out who's doing it to me, I'm not going to take it anymore. And I think it will stop once people understand who is doing it to them. If we can get enough people to understand it while we still have time. I'm giving you the address and cost of a book, a really ingenious book. It's called Corporate Crime, put out by Leonard Rafus in Princeton, Wisconsin. And he has a comic book. They're a dollar each. And just in this one issue, the most recent issue, he's got information about Karen Silkwood, the ITT scandal, an airplane scam, the old people's homes, the giant monopolies of land and water in California, Mr. San Diego, let's see, Arnold Smith. He hints on the Teapot Dome scandal and President Harding and the Doheny Oil. And he has an anti-monopoly game and some cartoons that aren't very funny but are really very good for teenagers or young people to read about the IUDs and the chemical plant in Japan, Minamata, Japan, the chemicals in the water and the people becoming deformed from them. It's a very good way for people to see how this information is being disseminated to the masses as well as in some of the more serious books and articles. It's called Corporate Crime, and it's a really good comic book. Yes, I read comic books such as this and Mad Magazine every month because I like to see what's reaching down to the next generation in their culture and see how much information is given to them in this form and keep up with this kind of information and with younger people who are reading it. I'm also giving you an address to write. Time is running out. This is now May 1979 and December 31st, 1979. Under the current laws, all past Nazis can get together and have a reunion and be free from any prosecutions. Their limitations are over. They will never more be prosecuted for war crimes. They're very wealthy. They're living in South America, Asia, South Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and all over South America, Central America, Mexico, and in the United States. And maybe I should do a couple of tapes on Nazi war criminals in the United States alone. Maybe that's long overdue. The statute of limitations is running out. I'm giving you a postcard address to write and get information to Chancellor Helmut Schmidt in Germany to keep this going for all times. There shouldn't be a statute of limitations on mass murder or any single kind of murder. I'm also giving you the address to send for information on the Nestle boycott. They've been sending Nestle's milk formula down to Africa and to underprivileged countries, third world countries, and the people are literally dying, killing off their children and starving them to death. It's a genocidal, dangerous process of sending milk where they mix it with contaminated water and discourage them from nursing and use the powdered milk and no refrigeration after it's mixed. And some of the women are burying their children and putting the Nestle's cans on the graves. Nestle's has many other products they make, such as Taster's Choice Coffee, Nescafe, Sunrise Coffee, and Quick, the chocolate drink, Stouffer's Food, Stouffer's Restaurants, Swiss Knight Cheese, Maggie Products, Libby McNeil Products, Cross and Blackwell Products, and I'm going to give you the address. I'm not going to list all of the products to boycott, but I'll give you the address, and you can send for this information. Donate anywhere, anything from 25 cents up to more if you want for their printing, and boycott the products until they stop sending this killer to the third world country and probably writing it off as a great tax generosity. They're killing children, large numbers of children, and the killing has to be stopped. So I'm giving the address where you can send for the information and boycott Nestle's and their subsidiaries and products until you find out that they have stopped killing these children. Last week on tape number 388, side one, I listed the pecking order of power and the police state that we're marching into, and also World War III, which we're getting closer to all the time. And at the top of that triangle of power, I remarked, it's Reagan's turn now, and Connally is second in command, meaning if Reagan doesn't run or if Reagan runs, John Connally could be the vice president. But you can't underestimate the power of Connally walking around with that JFK bullet in his leg, and also his role at Tyrol Bay with the ITT and Nazis and the group of people that were brought over here after World War II was over to prepare for this great Holocaust that will be known as World War III. I believe that Richard Nixon's role in Watergate, his appointment of Gerry Ford as the President of the United States, was to cover up the links of Watergate to the Kennedy assassination. And it may be that John Connally would be very important to cover up the continuous array of political assassinations. As the Secretary of the Treasury and Secretary of the Navy, he's had inroads that Ronald Reagan hasn't had, and Connally is still a very, very dangerous man to consider. Ronald Reagan could, he's almost 70, run for the president, have Connally as a vice president, and get a heart attack, and then Connally would appoint General Haig as his vice president. They could run together, Connally and Reagan, or Connally could run and appoint General Haig as his vice president and push Reagan out. It depends how much power the Pentagon needs to make that war in the Middle East against the Soviet Union, to line up all of these various countries, Israel and the Middle East with the southern flank, and of course NATO from the western side, and Japan and China from the east, making that final push against the Soviet Union if they can get away with it. There was an article in the paper this week, a very revealing article, a small one. The byline was Los Angeles Times. I don't know if you saw it or not. It was May the 15th. That was this last Wednesday. The article describes Carter aide joins John Connally. And it begins by saying it's potentially embarrassing to Jimmy Carter that a gentleman who works for him at the National Security Council by the name of Samuel Hoskinson is leaving Jimmy Carter to work for John Connally's campaign. Embarrassment isn't the word to use. Jimmy Carter has been embarrassed this year, but this is the understatement of the year. This is the prime spy of the Democratic Party, the Rockefeller Carter man leaving to get to the Pentagon Connally team. Jimmy Carter's been embarrassed this year. His wife's been photographed, Mr. Gracie in Chicago, the mass murderer. Photograph of Jim Jones, another mass murderer. He has a drunken brother with his anti-Semitic lobbying for Libya and his bad-mouthing various things going on in the world. His sister Ruth, who's organized Jews for Jesus with her very wealthy Texas Christian contacts. His mother's busy going to South Korea. She's a lobbyist all over the world for Jimmy. He's got a nephew in Soledad Prison or Vacaville now who was serving time for armed robbery, and Bert Lance with his sleazy banking deals, and Peter Bourne, his drug advisor, was caught prescribing Quaaludes under another name, and he himself is under a criminal investigation for bank loans. He's had an embarrassing year, but the point is that Jimmy Carter's role now is going to decline, and the Pentagon is making their strategic moves. When Richard Nixon was in office, and goodness knows how bad Richard Nixon was, he was spied upon by Admiral Moore. This came out at the time of Watergate. Moore was chief of staff, and he had Yeoman Redford stealing documents for Henry Kissinger right off the desk of Nixon. They had a paint of on the windowsill of the White House window, a bugging device of the National Security Agency and the Defense Agency against Nixon, and then he was taped. The tapes kicked him out of office, and those were done by Alex Butterfield and the Pentagon. Now, Mr. Samuel Hoskinson, as I say, is moving over to the other camp, to the Connally camp, and bringing with him all of Jimmy Carter's confidences, as well as the secrets of the intelligence agencies. He's worked for the National Security Council. He's been Jimmy Carter's chief intelligence aide. He's leaving the Democratic administration, resigning from Carter. He's going to help John Connally run for president of the United States. Mr. Hoskinson was responsible for the legislative and budget matters of the intelligence community, and the article describes how he's privy to the Carter administration policy on arms, arms verification, failures abroad, I guess specifically Iran, and other issues that will affect the 1980 campaign. He resigned this last Wednesday, and he will direct the issues for John Connally, the Republican, after serving Jimmy Carter, the Democrat. Mr. Brzezinski is the boss of Samuel Hoskinson in the National Security Agency, when they asked him, what do you think about his leaving Jimmy Carter to work for Connally? Brzezinski said, it's a free country. It's a darn free country, otherwise they wouldn't allow a Polish czarist Nazi like Brzezinski to be head of the National Security Council in the first place. He's leaving Brzezinski because the Carter ship is sinking and he's lining up to Connally, which means that if Connally becomes president or Reagan becomes president, we still end up with Mr. Brzezinski like Henry Kissinger. They are above political parties. They serve a much larger interest, and specifically, I would say, the Odessa, and they're working right along with these dogs. The excuse for leaving Jimmy Carter is that I have grown philosophically disaffected with Carter's policies on international issues. There's an article in the Los Angeles Times, March 23rd, just 2 months ago. The headline story says, concern shown over eavesdropping on Air Force One, and it goes into the fact that Jimmy Carter is bugged when he has his private conversations by the military, identical to when Richard Nixon was bugged, both by tapes and windowsill and Admiral Moore and black bag jobs. Another article by Jack Anderson, March 27, 1979. The back rooms of the Pentagon, the military strategists have been dismayed at Carter's extreme reluctance to use military muscle in the Middle East. Sources close to Carter say he has a passion for peace that can only be described as religious. It is against his convictions to resort to military measures, yet some of his generals and the admirals argue privately that peace is protected by firmness. Peace in Vietnam by opening up all the chemicals, the warfare, the displacement of people, the burning of homes, and so forth. This is what they call peace. And these are some inklings of the way the Pentagon feels about Jimmy Carter. And now they have this man leaving him and going to the Connally campaign. Mr. Hoskinson worked for the CIA. He took a year out to work for Chase Manhattan Bank and worked for the Rockefellers. And then he returned to the CIA in the mid-60s. That's according to the Los Angeles Times article. If he was at the Chase Manhattan in the early 60s, he was there when John Kennedy was killed. George de Morenchild, Lee Harvey Oswald's closest friend, was an associate of Nelson Rockefeller who carried blank checks and identifications when he went to Mexico many years earlier, and Donald Donaldson, who was murdered with 17 bullet holes in his head, had said that there was a link of Nelson Rockefeller to the Kennedy assassination. This spy worked for Nelson Rockefeller at Chase Manhattan, and of course now Nelson is dead and no longer a thorn in the side of Brzezinski and Kissinger and Schlesinger and that gang at the Pentagon. When James Schlesinger became the head of the CIA, and he was appointed by Nixon, and Nixon was to make General Haig his vice president, or not the vice president, but the chief aide. He took over Haldeman's job at the White House. When Schlesinger was the head of the CIA in 1973 at the height of Watergate, Hoskinson was the executive aide to Schlesinger, the man who's manipulating the oil shortages and the energy crisis. When William Colby came home from Vietnam and at his confirmation hearings before the CIA, as director of the CIA, he talked about killing 30 or 40,000 Vietnamese people just casually. The father of the Phoenix program in Vietnam, when he replaced Schlesinger and became head of the CIA, then Hoskinson was appointed by William Colby as the CIA's national intelligence officer for the Mideast. Colby came home, and Cyrus Vance and William Colby and Mr. Kissinger were unwinding the Vietnam travesty, the tragedy, and then they were all getting ready to move to the Middle East and get their tentacles into arming Africa and Asia. And Asia now, Laos and Cambodia are in turmoil, and Thailand and Vietnam, a tragedy of mangled people and mangled lives. And then these butchers, I don't know how they get the power or why we give them the power or why people don't do anything. But along comes Mr. Hoskinson, who then works for Colby and Schlesinger and Kissinger, and then he becomes an agent in the Middle East for Colby. He's sent over there as the CIA's intelligence advisor. In 1975, Hoskinson returned to the White House with Jimmy Carter, and he headed a three-man intelligence cluster, and he was retained as the special aide to Brzezinski when Carter took office in 1977. He could be the spy for Jimmy Carter, for Brzezinski, ever since that time. And now that Carter's on the way out, he's serving the Pentagon and John Connally and these dogs, and he's going over to the Connally team before the next elections to advise John Connally. Samuel Hodgkinson came from the Chicago area. He was a native Chicago born. Chicago is like Houston, Texas, and certain key seats, cities like Louisiana, New Orleans, Louisiana, Houston, Texas, the heart of the espionage operations, Muscle Shoals, Alabama, the NASA headquarters. You don't want to condemn a whole city just because, or a whole state, because he came from this Chicago, Illinois, but it's the home of Clement Stone, the financier, the great insurance salesman who funded Richard Nixon, who has worked out a complex mind control salesmanship program, who immediately paid and hired Dwight Chapin, the appointment secretary for Nixon, through his internment in prison and hired him afterwards. Chicago was a headquarters of E. Howard Hunt and Robert Mayhew when he worked with Guy Bannister in the FBI, and then Bannister went down to New Orleans to open an office with Lee Harvey Oswald on Camp Street, and it's the home of Charles Bates, the FBI director who went on to Washington to cover up the Watergate investigation for the FBI. He was in Chicago during the COINTEL operations of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, those murders, and then went to San Francisco in 72 to set up the Seminis Liberation Army. This Hodgkinson is a native from the city where all this counterintelligence and CIA operations blended with the FBI. He's been on the National Security Council as a staffer on and off since 1969 after leaving Chase at Manhattan. I don't know what the on and off goes, when he was on and when he was off. What war school did he go to? What spy school did he go to? What did he do at the National Security Council? He was a classmate of General Haig's at Georgetown University. He was recruited and picked up by Henry Kissinger. At the time Kissinger picked up Haig, he was a close friend of and his schoolmate, the two men, Hodgkinson and Haig, and Kissinger plucked Haig, and he immediately jumped over 34 other men to get his promotions and the tutelage, and of course Kissinger at that time, and always was representing the Chase Manhattan, David and Nelson Rockefeller, and the Defense Department, the CIA, the National Security Agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, serve a handful of multinationals, maybe 200 corporations, and move the armies wherever they can make profit. Fascism, torture, and murders is their game, and in this team, now switching over to John Connally, working for Carter until this moment, are a team of Haig, Connally, and Samuel Hodgkinson ganging up, and with Henry Kissinger and Brzezinski. Haig resigned as commander of NATO. He said he might run as president. I could see him as a strong vice president to Connally. Then if the Watergate rug were pulled out from under Connally for various charges that were never cleared up in investigations, you'd have Haig becoming the president that way, or Connally and Haig running with Reagan. You can't underestimate the power of these people. Hoskins joined the CIA while he was at Georgetown. He worked closely with General Haig. He worked at the Chase Manhattan in New York. He worked with the CIA. He's up to his ears in espionage. He has the inroad in the Carter politics, and now he is going to John Connally, where he will carry all the expertise of what Carter did or didn't do, and Connally can begin a strong foreign policy campaign and have the ear of a man who was working for Jimmy Carter up to this time. The president is a tool, a lackey. He is spied upon. The Pentagon has control of him. They're never prosecuted when they spy on him or take papers off of his desk. If Admiral Moore had been prosecuted for stealing from Nixon, then these people couldn't leave Jimmy Carter's offices and go to Connally's. These agents and residents can steal from the president, overthrow the country, and act in a very, it's not even very surreptitious anymore. They're so blatant about it. But this is a team member that has now left Jimmy Carter and is working for John Connally. So the noose gets tighter, and we become the victims of their manipulations, and it will lead the road to World War III. I don't see any way to avoid it, because that's what they're hell-bent on doing, is destroying this planet, no matter what the cost and how much it takes to do it. They have the weapons and the know-how, and nothing can stop them unless you make up your minds that you've had enough and you don't want any more. Now, leading up to Dan White and the trial in San Francisco, because I want to do some more on that where we left off last week. The mind control of Dan White, preceding the specifics on that, I have to go into the articles in the newspaper this week. Jim Jones' hit squad exists. And I'm sure you saw that. That was a story that was covered in all the major media. On national television, they said People's Temple hit team is possible. And George Birds, B-E-R-D-E-S, from the House Foreign Affairs Committee, just finished an investigation into People's Temple and the shooting of Leo Ryan. And he came to the conclusion that they may not be organized now, but they are out there, the assassination teams. The assassination teams are never organized. Sirhan wasn't organized into the plot. The killing of Mayor Moscone was only organized when you look for the organization, and they wouldn't know a hit team when they see one, because Harvey Milk and George Moscone were part of the hit team and number one on the list of people to be assassinated. But the Mexican assassination teams that had moved down from Oaxaca, Mexico, that I mentioned on the tapes in August of 78, that could move down to Guyana and be trained as Mexican assassins on that agricultural farm, are never investigated. The organization behind these things is never investigated. The Carter assassination attempt in Los Angeles just last month, and the arrests of these people, or just a few weeks ago, actually, it was in the news last week that we did a tape on. Mr. George Birdies of the House Foreign Affairs Committee wouldn't even begin to think that the assassination attempt on Jimmy Carter was real down in Los Angeles. As I say, Dan White played a part of that team as a zombie that is useful, just as Jack Ruby was a sleeper assassin as part of a team, and very few people have even put that together yet. The FBI suspected for a long time, according to the House Foreign Affairs Committee, that there were killer squads, and said in the paper this week that they're under surveillance, but they've made no arrest because it isn't possible to do it yet. Well, of course, Mark Lane is sitting with Terry Buford, who knows who the assassination teams are. They know where the 14 banks are, the international banks in the Bahamas and Panama and elsewhere, and France and Switzerland. They know where the $26 million is. And as I've said over and over again on radio shows and tapes, there are either 120 or 220, depending how you count it or who you believe, that got away, that did the murdering at Jonestown and then got away, because there were either 1,200 people there, which Jim Jones said that day to Congressman Ryan, or there were 1,100 people, as Mark Lane said, but that still leaves 120 to 220 potential killers who could have mass murdered these 913, and they're alive. They could be trained, these people, from 1973 up through 1979. The property was secured and observed by Jim Jones in 63, and goodness knows who was using the CIA Matthews Ridge Station or the property up until the time that Jim Jones moved down with these people. The hit list has about 40 names on it, of congressmen, national leaders, state officials, and private citizens, and this is something we're going to live with. The newspaper report by George Birdies at the House of Foreign Affairs Committee said, in quotes, "Jonestown had a contingency conspiracy to kill Leo Ryan if Jones failed to convince the congressman the conditions were good." This just came out this last Wednesday. For those of you who don't have the regular recordings of these tapes, on tape number 367, and that was back in December, that was 6 months ago, in 1978, I had in that outline of Jonestown the Roman numerals 1, the motives for Jonestown. What is it? These are my working outlines of it. Section 2, the contingency plans made a long time ago, nothing to do with son. In other words, it had nothing to do with Tim and Grace Stone wanting their son, and that's because everybody was killed. There were contingency plans that were made in case any congressional person or public official went down to Jonestown. And I talked about those contingency plans 6 months ago, and now the House committee is saying that there were contingency plans to kill everybody if Leo Ryan went there. That's one of the reasons I like doing these tapes and getting this down for you, so you can follow some of my facts and thinking, and it's dated, and then the committees come out later. They missed so many points of their investigations, but the means to kill everybody was there if Ryan left with anybody. Now, what happened was that when he wanted to take 15 people away with him, 15 people asked to leave, the contingency that was there to murder everybody. On the other side of this tape, because we're running out of space shortly, I'll go into briefly the contingency plans and then get into Dan White and the San Francisco murder of number one on the list. That was Mayor Moscone, George Moscone, and Supervisor Harvey Milk. As I said before, if anybody came down there to see the place, then everyone had to be murdered. And a picture proof of why they had to be murdered is on the cover of Newsweek, December the 4th, 1978. And I'll talk about that briefly, and then you can look that up for yourself. If you don't have a Newsweek magazine and a time, it's the same date, December the 4th, 1978. And I just want to call attention to these bodies. I might have done this before, but I think it's important because this is what Congressman Ryan or other people would see.